movements of Mahatma Gandhi.
The disruption he did to the British Empire, economic disruption, was really violent.
Okay, but then
that's what you mean by
violent. What we always do is in these non-violent action trainings that I mentioned, we practice non-violence, and one of the things is that we do like a scale where we say here's violence, there's non-violence, and then we take different scenarios. If you smash a window, for example, then people place themselves on the scale. If it's violent or not, everyone puts themselves differently. Because everyone, like what violence actually is considered very differently. I think the important part of non-violence that I mentioned is first against humans, my personal the second, but the second one is that you get the, what do you say, if the people emphasize with you that they want to join. That's the most important part. If you smash a window, it's only problematic if people think it's wrong.
Can I react on this? Actually, Extinction Rebellion is the first organization who really tries to put a real gathering together, but also gives the opportunity to make workshops like non-violent direct actions. The NVDA is actually a free workshop for everyone, so everyone can be involved, but also really get the opportunity to not only practice it, but really get the opportunity to be able to do it. And then the awareness, the social awareness is higher because we're on the cloud, we're online, we're focusing on faster and much more disruption that leads non-violence. So actually, your opinion from the past made us learn more and focus more, and of course you're keeping it sharp. But if you focus on non-violence, that's really different from the past. Different from the way Gandhi acted with his crew and the way Nelson Mandela acted and communicated with his crew.
Maybe I can jump in here. First of all, saying one thing that the activists of Extinction Rebellion do as soon as they get interested is to join one of these non-violent direct action training. It's an interesting experience where you are actually taught about both the practical and political and legal background of civil disobedience. That's the first thing, and it's advisable to everybody to do that before the actions. We can say that more. Another thing I can say is about the civil disobedience. So the idea in this case is to expose, to make visible the actual legal violence that is made by the state to the demonstration. So that's why Len mentioned the fact to be arrested, which involves basically to be carried in a room for a couple of hours. That's what happened in Holland until now, and be given a fine. So this civil disobedience acts upon laws, the break of laws that are innocent enough, but important enough to be arrested, to expose the violence that the state does towards concerned inhabitants. So in fact, part of the organizing teams, they are very careful in choosing what type of laws and what type of actions to target, in order to avoid physical violence, in fact, which is, of course, clearly not the one that is at stake here. And so this is a bit in a nutshell how they approach the problem of violence. I hope you can go also on YouTube, by the way. There's a lot of videos since Rebellion talking about civil disobedience where you can get more information about this.
Examples of what sort of actions?
Yes.
I was just looking.
I can
just go on the website, I think.
You can say also the one that were done in the Netherlands.
So like one typical one is swarming, which means that you split up into small groups. It's quite that's actually one that is quite discussed also in the movement. You split up into small groups, 15 or 20. I have like 5 or 6 or 10 of these in the city. And then you block certain roads just for a certain while. And you're in a way violent, if you want, because you disrupt people's daily life.
We just want to stand in the street.
Yeah, so like we have
cars stop for you.
Right. I mean, there's more organization around it. You have banners, you talk to the people in the cars and stuff. Like there's a lot of organization around it, but it's disruptive. The typical thing is going to the cities, blocking an iconic site, and like a street, a bridge. They did this in London, 3 bridges, and we're going to this in Amsterdam, and establishing kind of a camp. That's also form of civil disobedience. And the third one, which is more in the direction of some people call it lone wolf actions because they're a bit more intense, is where we glue ourselves to, for example, the Shell headquarters and block the entrance like that. We forced the police to carry us away from Shell, which was quite interesting because we claim or we are convinced that Shell is the criminal, but we are carried away by the state and it exposes very well what group rules the state protects and which ones don't. So this action was also really powerful.
So, but you don't want the police.
No.
Actually, the relation between the movement and the police is very dark. There is
we constantly in touch with
that. Exactly. That's also very interesting in this question. Is that there is always a continuous communication between the movement and the police. So in the Netherlands, as you know, as many countries in Europe, you have the right to demonstrate in public space without authorization. So everybody can demonstrate in public space without being authorized. The only obligation you have is to communicate. And that's what the Extinction Rebellion does, as a particular team, the legal team, that takes care also of the communication with the police and informs of all the details of the actions of the police. This allows the police to be prepared. Of course, the police does not authorize these actions. Of course not. The police prepares the situation also for demonstrants that have the right to demonstrate. Then what happens is that after a certain amount of disruptive capacity, a certain disruption, for example, keeping the traffic stuck for 4 days, the police may decide to intervene and clean up the demonstration by removing the people and holding them for a fine. This will happen, and happens, and this is the philosophy also of the movement, to make this happen in a controlled way. But the actions are always discussed. I was actually present in one demonstration where the police congratulated us, even,
for
to say how good we are to organize, which was paradoxical.
Yes.
Yes.
That's the Netherlands, yes. But it's also something that's described in the UK. The respect for power is very important. We want to build relationships with the police because ultimately we want to create a lot of pressure that becomes uncomfortable for the state. And they are very important to have good relations with the police. And a lot of individuals who work for the police are actually on our side. Like they save us a lot of times. They say sorry when they put us, like when they take us. Like they tell us very clearly that they are on our side. Some of them. Therefore, it's very important to build these relations. You undermine also the system from inside.
How do you think it will have an economic effect so much? Like, I don't see so much, 1,000 people get going to jail, get fined, and there's some publicity, but
I think
to me, it's not really. It will not affect the government so much.
But if you, so what I see in London, if you block actually the main infrastructure in the capital for several weeks, I do think that it has quite an economic impact. And this is what we can expect from London. And there's actually, there are these two things that you mentioned, of the getting arrested part, which is very symbolic also. But also, if you want to get arrested at some point, you fill up the prisons or the jails. So you can't, you can actually stay in the area because they can't arrest you at some point anymore. And there's the economic side, where you create economic disruption in the capitals.
Well, people can go to work or something, that is the economic effect.
Yeah,
There are examples. For example, there are different degrees of interruptions. The idea is to interrupt the process of the economy. One is the swarming, which interrupts for 5 minutes, one traffic light, in order to communicate to the drivers, for example, the reason why this happens. This is one of the easiest cases that was done in last. For example, there are also debates about interrupting the airport. For example, Greenpeace is actually organizing a civil disobedience action on the Schiphol airport. So there are also other infrastructures. The actions of the October will be, maybe we didn't say the location.
It's the Rijks Museum, so it's on the street there. And there are many dimensions. There's economic disruption, there's the imprisonment part, but there's also the central in the city.
I just got a message from Greenpeace. On Sunday there will be a die-in on Schiphol.
Yeah.
So anyone who wants to come there, it's exactly the time. Sure, I should say it, of course, right. 11:25, Extinction Rebellion has announced this with Greenpeace together. So
everybody knows what a die-in means.
It's this one. It's a symbolic action. You go into a space and you don't just protest, but you. So
in general, what Extinction Rebellion also does a lot of symbolic actions, like beautiful actions, theatrical actions, and the dial is one of these forms. So you have the speaker and you have a couple of people who do leaflets, but you especially claim a space by pretending, well, you're lying on the ground and you die in this area, and connect this to the speech that you give. And it's a very simple form of doing an action, something you can set up a day or two if you mobilize quickly enough, but it has quite some effect to draw people in. And the good thing with this is also it's quite low threshold to draw. It's not the main theory of change that we create, change through the science, but it's very important for the movement to draw and for the movement to become more coherent. And people learn how to do actions, people learn how to organize. And we do them quite regularly in different spaces. We did them, for example, also in Zaudas, at the bank, in the banking forums.
Yeah, so this one is in Schiphol, 11:25. So anyone who can be there?
Thank you. What's another question?
Yeah. This is mostly directed towards the government, but there's no talk about the consumer, so you and me. So, like, the government is one part, but we also support the government. We hold everything together, right? So, why is there no talk about this?
First of all, one of the creators of Extinction Rebellion, Gail, said that Extinction Rebellion has an ecology of theories of change. For me, that's an ecosystem, which I think is quite useful to think about like this. So we have this main demand to focus on the government, and it kind of holds the movement together. We have some lines through which we create change, focusing on the government, civil disobedience, regenerative culture is very central. We kind of create a new type of thinking that we want to life and the movement. And other forms appear, like because it's decentralized. People do actually, there is no Extinction Rebellion legalism. So it does appear, it's just not the main focus of the movement. And the other thing that I observe is that when you and I now start protesting against the government to impose laws on us to be carbon neutral by 2035, then you come yourself to the conclusion that you should stop eating meat. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that happens a lot. Like a lot of people come themselves to the conclusion without me going up to you and demanding it from you.
Yeah. And it's probably also you want to force the government to force the consumer to be
both.
More CO2 friendly.
It is still both. Like the main view of change is that comes from the government, but there will be, there is of course already a lot of bottom up change going on. I mean, people stop eating meat or stop flying or whatever. This does happen at the same time bottom up. But I do think it's also an effect from movements like the Extinction Rebellion, as far as the future demand and action from the government. It's kind of paradoxical.
I'm sorry to push, but I do, because I really believe you are one of the strongest groups we have. I really have a lot of hope. I wanted to ask you, is there, presumably you have discussions about what the next action will be,
yeah.
And planning, some kind of planning. In those discussions, I wonder whether other. Does it come into the discussion to have actions that don't only go for a spectacular that will have visual impact or symbolic impact, because you're extremely good at that, but that will have an economic impact? For example, blocking the function of the nuclear power plant in the Netherlands, blocking the entrance of any labor worker there for a month, then the whole system is going to collapse. This will have an impact, and everybody will suffer from it. And if you will, so I was wondering, how ambitious is a horrible word, but how ambitious are you with the rebellion action? How far are you prepared to take it?
So, thank you. Allow us to clarify also why the strategy has been selected.
And that's non-violent, by the way.
Yes, non-violent.
Yeah.
There are many groups already doing this. A small subtype.
Yeah.
One is Codero. Many people know Codero.
Yeah.
And actually, some people of Codero are involved in Extinction Rebellion too, because Extinction Rebellion is decentralized and very fluid system. But then what the research has demonstrated, basically by the same activist, that these actions do not bring the effect that is desired. The effect that is desired is not only to interrupt the economy, but is to create a public concern, an opinion. And what has been demonstrated is that these movements did not manage to grow into a fully fledged social movement that includes all kind of social categories, also because they kept acting on this strategy. While I think Extinction Rebellion strategy, as far as is how I understand it, is working on the other way, so working on the building of consensus, hopefully up to a 4% of the total population. The number is based on some research of the country. So to build up the consensus and the visibility that will increase the positive feedback loop of creating more consensus in order to actually press the government to do the decisions, the rapid decisions which are necessary. The experience of Code Road has shown that that actions exclude the people that don't want to be sabotaging things, and they feel that this is a form of violence. And that's clearly the case, but has pushed away those people and made these movements relatively marginal, in fact, in the public opinion, actually demonizing the movement itself in some cases. Unfortunately, this is a bit what happened. That's why I think, as I understand, this rebellion is carefully choosing the type of blockages to do. I mean, stopping the road in front of the Rijks Museum for maybe a week will create a lot of public visibility.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually see it a bit different. Extinction Rebellion is now 9 months old. The Extinction Rebellion is now 9 months old in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So we took up a lot of the tactics and, you know, stuff from the UK and just repeated it. We have now the second cycle of these rebellions, extremely effective to get people involved. Like, so far it worked really well. But what I see in the UK is exactly this, what I mentioned earlier, with the ecosystem of theories of change, whatever you call it, that they do more and more different types of actions in the UK. And it's still based on decentralization. So the movement also offers you a platform to organize these things. And we do need to think carefully. I think it is very important, that we get the support of the broader population, but at the same time, we want to be disruptive. So
why? The majority of the population votes for neoliberal governments. Why is it so important to get the support?
No, I don't say majority. Yeah. Like, we need enough people, like 3-5%.
So you are reformist. Yeah, there's nothing rebellious about it. I just say spade to spade. You're reformist.
No.
And you want to keep yourselves white and clean.
No.
You don't want to be called rebellious, or what was the word you used? To be demonized. Yeah.
No, but I didn't say majority. We don't need a majority of society to be behind us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 2-4%. But what I wanted to say is that I think after this rebellion, we will be much more pushing for decentralization, that people do action. So we will still continue doing cycles that are organized, like, as an organization, but it's still also movement. It's just way too big right now. Like, they are, I think, 1,000 people on the
Netherlands.
And why
is decentralization good by default? I don't understand.
Because
we
grow much quicker. Like, we can't organize it that quickly.
Maybe.
Because hierarchy is much better for organizing.
Maybe what we can do is to explain how it's organized.
Yeah?
Yes.
That
would help.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we have, what is it here? Well, that's a basic, very basic. The idea is that we have these circles, you're organized on international level, and each country basically is a circle if you want. We have a representative and a facilitator for each country. The representatives stay in touch with each other. And the same happens kind of on different scales. Okay, the kind of the same structure on the national level should make decisions like organizing the rebellion week right now. But we also have below that, if you want, local groups that organize their own actions again. And they do a lot of stuff in the local groups. They follow the principles and values. We have like a basic strategy like that we continuously update and that they can follow, but in principle they can do their actions, and they're doing a lot. they're now organized in these 15 or 16 local groups, and I don't see how we should have done this in a centralized way. I'm still overwhelmed how quickly this evolved. Like, 9 months ago we were 10 people who came together in Crea and said, hey, let's start Extinction Rebellion. And now we have like 1,000 people in the Netherlands organizing this. I don't see how we should have done this in a centralized way. And I do see a lot of tactics in that. And the actions that you just mentioned, I think they will happen. We still have to, it's a constant negotiation in the movement how we relate to certain actions that we think, for example, nuclear power plant, I think that would be quite stupid because it would blow up if we block it.
But there is Endegalen, for example, which is really many people, especially that went there. And, I mean, I've heard you to this. Maybe I can add bit on the structure because it's very interesting. So you had this, you had to share knowledge and coordinate also to train and do these talks. And so the movement, which is 100 people, is organized into what they are called circles, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the circles, there's one which is about political strategy, that's where you are. There's one that is about art and outreach. One is about
finance. Tech, media communication.
These circles are open, important. Everybody can join the circles. So they are completely open, and in this circle there are these topics discussed. And what happened also is that people are in this circle, but also are activists themselves, and they form affinity groups. The affinity group is a smaller group of people, maybe 10 or 15 people, that basically can also autonomously initiate actions. So it's fully decentralized in that sense that there are also small groups that can do small actions. Sometimes they paint the streets, sometimes they throw a blood, fake blood on the street, things like that. And also you have all these meetings where the people come together and train themselves. So you have the training for the non-violent action, non-violent direct action. You have the training on legal issues, you have the meeting on political strategy group, and of course there's also a coordination team where some of the representatives of all the circles rotate and go and discuss with the others. So the organization is relatively complex, but what is interesting is that it kind of works in a way that is very organic, and at the end there is also this subgroups, affinity groups that can have the initiative to do actions as far as they somehow agree also on the basic principles.
Right.
Can you tell a bit more about the affinity groups, like how does that work and how that will?
How is exactly organized for this rebellion, people haven't looked into this yet, but the basic principle you described. So you just want to have as much autonomy as possible, so that things can happen quickly. So people organize in these affinity groups, they meet, mostly they share certain things in common, so like, for example, risk level, if they want to be arrested or not, or they are maybe all people from the art circle and they work on a certain project together, and they can do actions together. And these affinity groups are also really useful when we are then in the blockade on the 7th of October, because there is, of course, a lot of planning for it, but also a lot of uncertainty. But with these affinity groups, you can react much quicker. First of all, they have representatives that can communicate with each other. They rotate, so that in principle is a quick way of communicating, but also they can start actions. Let's say if we have 3,000 people in this blockade in front of museum, there's, in my opinion, we have to decide this, no point of staying there with all people. We can start other actions in the city. These affinity groups allow that because they are organized already. And what you mentioned is there is this balance. You can view Extinction Rebellion as an organization, or you can see it as a movement. And this is what I mentioned. Like, there's not this one grand strategy for Extinction Rebellion. To a certain degree, it is there, the things that describe with the cycles and stuff. To a large degree, it's also not there. And these actions, you know, join, convince people, and I think Extinction Rebellion offers you a great platform to start exactly these kinds of actions. But it is still continuously negotiated.
Maybe on the affinity group, it's important. I mean, if you are, not familiar with Extinction Rebellion, you want to start being involved, most of the people go to a training, for example, where they meet other people of different kinds, and there are also moments to form affinity group with people that might be in your neighborhood or people that you might feel, you know, there is a clique. This is a very important moment also for the actions, because the affinity group also ensures that there is a care for each other in situation that might be a bit tense. So you have people that might, for example, wait for you out of the police station when you get out. There is other people that will assist, for example, somebody sitting on the street, assist and be sure that they have water and they have food. That happens as well. So it's a bit of a self-help, self-organized small cell, let's put it this way, of the whole movement. And it's actually built in these trainings.
Yeah, I know there's also a buddy system in the affinity group, like two people are connected to each other and they
have... So, I mean, that's a kind of a common thing as well, right? So that you just have two people pairing up as well, that even if in smaller kind of level of community, they can stick together. I'm not sure if we have to test it, but people have recommended to do it. Any other questions? It goes about other aspects of the presentation.
Where's the location? TBA.
Oh yeah, sorry. it will be on the website. Like, on the website, like it's to be announced, TBA. So it's not clear yet.